From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today, the challenges of feeding a rapidly growing global population.
We're looking at having to grow as much food in the next 40 years as we have since agriculture began 10,000 years ago. It is the greatest challenge that humanity has ever faced.
Journalist Joel Bourne discusses the impacts of genetically modified crops, biofuels like ethanol, and water shortages on the world's food supply. And then there's global warming.
We're starting to see the demand pressures outstrip our ability to produce food, while things like climate change are really starting to hammer us.
Bourne's new book is The End of Plenty. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel A God in Ruins by Kate Atkinson, and rock historian Ed Ward has an appreciation of soul singer Jackie Moore. That's coming up on today's Fresh Air.
Thanks for listening to Fresh Air. Here's another podcast you might want to check out, the TED Radio Hour. You'll hear discussions about questions like, when does learning begin? Are we at the end of privacy? What does the road from curiosity to discovery look like? The program is about new ideas, astonishing inventions, fresh approaches to old problems, and new ways to think and create. You can find the TED Radio Hour podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Citrix GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings. Because think about the time, money, and hassle it takes to hold a meeting. Citrix GoToMeeting is designed to make it easy to meet with your team whenever you need to, wherever you are. With GoToMeeting, you can meet from any computer or mobile device, share screens to collaborate in real time, and turn on webcams to see each other in HD video. Right now, Citrix is offering a 30-day free trial. Go to meeting.com and click on the Try It Free button to get started.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off today. In the 1960s, the farmers of Egypt grew enough wheat to feed the country and export some to its neighbors. But as the country's population grew, its farmers couldn't keep up, and Egypt is now the world's largest importer of wheat. When international food prices spiked in 2008, there were bread riots in the streets of Cairo. Our guest, Joel Bourne, says Egypt's problems illustrate a terrifying fact facing all humanity. The world is running out of food. In his new book, Bourne chronicles the trends making it likely we'll see more hunger and malnutrition in coming decades. While the Earth's population is growing rapidly, our ability to feed it is undermined by a loss of arable land due to climate change, growing water shortages, the use of valuable farmland to grow biofuels, and the fact that many of us eat so much meat, which is a highly inefficient way to use the grain we grow. Bourne says there are some promising developments and ways to meet the threat, but time is running out. Joel Bourne got a degree in agronomy before becoming a journalist. He's a contributing writer to National Geographic and has written for Audubon, Science, and Outside Magazine. His new book is called The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. Well, Joel Bourne, welcome to Fresh Air. You grew up in rural North Carolina, a little town, and you write that you always thought you'd be a farmer. Why? What appealed to you about it?
Well, you know, my father, who was a small-town attorney, I always wanted to be a farmer. He actually farmed my grandfather's land when he came back from World War II. My grandfather discouraged him from doing that and made him go to law school. But he spent the bulk of his life and most of his, nearly all of his free time out working on the farm, where he would drag me with him. So I grew up working in tobacco, chopping cotton and peanuts, hunting and fishing in the streams around the farm. So when it became time for me to choose a college, I only picked one. I pretty much knew I was going to be a farmer. And so applied to one university, NC State, and got into the ag program in 1981.
So you studied agronomy. How did the field strike you?
You know, it was interesting. I landed there just happy as I could be. I thought it was like Brer Rabbit. I'd been thrown into the briar patch. Loved the guys I was around, admired my professors, and, you know, but about the end of my sophomore year, I really started having qualms. I started sort of losing my interest in production agriculture. It seemed like it was much more based on chemistry and herbicides and things that I just wasn't as interested in. And I really started losing faith in it.
So it was agribusiness as opposed to the kind of farming that you'd seen as a kid?
Well, I had two different generations. My grandfather loved to hunt on the farm. And so he liked everything to be brushy and, you know, messy, much like the organic farms we see today, which are certainly not weed-free. And, of course, there was tons of wildlife on the farm. He was a quail hunter, so he loved to hunt. But when he passed away in 1972, this was right during Earl Butz, the Secretary of Agriculture, who was imploring American farmers to plant fence row to fence row, that we were going to turn, really flex the muscle of American and agribusiness and start feeding the world. And so my father, who was a good conservationist, but also, you know, an admirer of that way of thinking, cleaned up the farm and really bought into this whole mantra of the Green Revolution. All the old fence rows and hedgerows that provided such great habitat for wildlife went away. I took down many of the cattle fences myself, sold all the cows, and basically we went into major production agriculture.
So you decided not to become a farmer in the end. You write that, you know, you would have had to borrow a lot of money to get into a field that didn't appeal to you that much. What did you do instead?
Well, it was really funny. I graduated in 1985. It was the midst of the first great farm crisis in the United States, where crop prices were terribly low. And Willie Nelson and John Mellencamp and Neil Young were sponsoring Farm Aid. Their first Farm Aid concert was the year I graduated, because so many farmers were going bankrupt. So I had taken some English classes and journalism classes and really liked it. I ended up traveling a lot after college, going to New Zealand, worked on a dairy farm there, went to Australia, worked on a big wheat farm there, and then into Indonesia, where I watched rice production throughout those beautiful rice paddies in Bali and Java. But when I got back home, as much as I loved the farm, I just couldn't find myself going back into farming. So I went and became a journalist instead.
You say early in the book that the world is running out of food. And I'd like you to begin by just giving us an overview of some of the dimensions of the problem and some of the pretty scary statistics that tell the story.
Sure. I've been reporting on these sort of environmental skirmishes at National Geographic since about 2000. So I was looking, I reported on the drought in California, I reported on wetland loss down in Louisiana. And I'd done several issues on climate change where I was either editing or writing stories myself. So, and then when the food crisis hit in 2007, 2008, all these sort of disparate brush fires around the world really came together. And so suddenly, you had an instance where the world began consuming fairly consistently more of these major grains than it was producing, whittling down stockpiles to levels we haven't seen since the 1970s. So, for example, in the 1970s, we consumed or utilized more grain than we ate only about 4 years out of the decade. In the drier 80s, it was about 5 years. Since 2000, we've consumed or utilized more of these feed grains in 8 of the first 12 years of the decade. So really, we're starting to see the demand pressures outstrip our ability to produce food. All this while, our yield gains that have been spectacular since Norman Borlaug introduced the Green Revolution agriculture in the 50s and 60s started to plateau. So just as our demands are starting to rise, we're starting to plateau in the amount of grain we're getting per hectare, while things like climate change are really starting to hammer us. So we're looking at, you know, these major disruptions of our food supply. There was a heat wave in Europe in 2003 that killed like 73,000 people in Europe. And yet, that would made headlines all over the world. But what people didn't realize was that a third of the wheat and grain and fruit crops were decimated that year. You know, Russia has had these enormous droughts events where they've lost up to a third to half of their crop. Here in the United States, we've had 2012, 2013, you know, we had the worst drought since the Dust Bowl days. It cost us $30 billion. So, and what we're dealing with is sort of the new normal. You know, the researchers say that now we're going to have to, because of the increased demand from population growth, increased meat consumption in developing parts of the world, that we're going to have to double our grain production, our food production, by 2050 to make sure everyone's reasonably fed. And yet, climate change is just starting to really hammer it down. So we're in a bit of a pinch.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with science writer Joel Born. His new book about the challenges of feeding a growing world population is called The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. You know, you write in the book that 80 to 90% of the calories we eat come from three crops, wheat, rice, and corn. And in the 1960s, there was this dramatic increase in agricultural yields that we call the Green Revolution. Just tell us the story in brief. What happened?
Well, it was very interesting. After World War II, there was a lot of hunger in the world. Up to 30% of the world's population was chronically malnourished. Mexico was having a real problem feeding its people. They were depending on more and more imports from the United States. So the Rockefeller Foundation, at the request of the vice president of the United States, went down to Mexico to see if they could do anything about it. And at that time, a young plant physiologist named Norman Borlaug was working for DuPont, and they recruited him to go down and started a wheat breeding program in Mexico. First, to start to deal with wheat rust, which was the scourge, was decimating yields down there, and they were having difficult problems with it. So Borlaug went down and started this massive breeding program, and his goal initially was successful. I mean, he defeated wheat rust, developing a suite of genes that are still used in most commercial wheat varieties today. But in the meantime, he also developed a deal where he transformed wheat into this tall, wispy plant that tended to not yield so well and fall over, to this very short-stemmed plant that if you gave it enough nitrogen, enough phosphorus, enough water, it would yield like crazy. So he revolutionized, with these heavy input, chemical-intensive agriculture, our ability to feed ourselves. So even though population has nearly tripled since he started his program in the 1950s, you know, we have more than kept up with this massive influx of wheat. And his same techniques were used in the production of new types of rice, where they created dwarf rice varieties that did much the same thing and were equally successful and just explosive yield growth.
And some people even believe that the decline in poverty and the increase in the health of tens of millions of people is what allowed a number of developing countries to industrialize, right?
That's right. Jeff Sachs has been one of the big – at Columbia, the economist has been is one of the strongest proponents of that theory, that, you know, you reduced food prices so much in these parts of the world that were so desperate, Southeast Asia particularly, and Latin America, you not only allowed them to eat healthier and to spend more money on a more varied diet, but you also, and this is part of the social cost of the Green Revolution, you moved a lot of these guys off the farm, these small, less efficient farmers who provided the labor for what became, you know, the Asian tiger phenomena, or, you know, even China and India becoming the great manufacturing powerhouses of the world that they're becoming. So it had a tremendous impact. It was, you know, sort of equivalent to the Industrial Revolution that occurred during the time of Malthus, who was one of the first people to write about this relationship between population and food.
Okay, so applied science gives us enormous yields in food production and reduces hunger around the world, makes us healthier. But there were downsides. What were they?
There certainly were downsides. I mean, now we've got rampant fertilizer running into our wetlands and streams. We've created plants that thrive, but only under with these high input type of scenarios. So they need water, they need a lot of fertilizer, and they also need, because you're growing a lot of plants close together, they need a fair number of pesticides in order to keep things, insects and weeds, at bay. All of these things end up in our waterways, end up in our watersheds, and now, of course, we're seeing dead zones at the end of the Mississippi every year, the size of New Jersey, Connecticut. You're seeing them all over the world. It's like something like 300 million square kilometers of coastal zones that are now every year dead zones because of this algal bloom that's fueled by all this fertilizer going off into the water. So that has led to an enormous cost.
So we have all this productivity, but it's caused harmful environmental and health effects and now can't keep up with the growth in the world's population. I want to talk about some other dimensions of the problem, and one of them is the amount of arable land that is used to produce biofuels. These are, you know, alternatives to gas or gasoline as we look for more energy sources to run cars and other equipment. To what extent are biofuels like corn ethanol a part of the problem here?
Sure. Well, this has been a hugely controversial issue because we had these huge subsidy programs from the government that came in to kickstart the biofuel industry. And this is basically, in the United States, it's ethanol made from corn, and it now takes up 40% of the U.S. corn crop every year. So that's an enormous amount of land devoted to basically feeding our cars. We also make biodiesel out of things like soybean, canola, rapeseed, which is more popular in the United States. In Europe, where about half the cars run on diesel. So over there, they've had a huge, like 8 to 12% of their arable land devoted to biofuel crops, canola and sunflower seeds, things like that. And even though the biofuel industry disputes this hotly, most of the economists in the world, between the World Bank and the IMF and the OECD, point their fingers squarely at biofuels as having a major impact on driving up food prices around the world.
And the reasons that's happening is that as gasoline prices go up, as crude oil prices go up, that provides an incentive for farmers to make money by growing biofuels. So you essentially now have food prices linked directly to energy prices.
Exactly. So now grain prices, especially those that are related to biofuels, are directly related to the price of the extremely volatile price of oil. So now we've enjoyed some nice low oil prices over the last few years. But anyone who thinks they're going to continue is probably going to be in a rude awakening. So as soon as energy prices start to go back up, you're going to see rises in grain prices because of this direct connection between fuel and biofuel.
The other side of the equation in this problem is how many mouths there will be to feed in coming decades. What trends are we seeing in population growth?
Well, and again, this is the scariest thing. The UN population unit, which provides the basic estimates for population growth that most of the experts look at, you know, has been ramping up its figures, its sort of median figure for population, world population by 2050 in the last three estimates. So, you know, 2009, we were only supposed to get about 8.9 billion. 2011, no, 9.3. 2012, now it's up to 9.6. So 9.6 billion people is their median level, which is typically their most accurate, by 2050, rising to almost 11 billion by the end of the century. So we are looking at, you know, as one plant breeder at Purdue University said, we're looking at having to grow as much food in the next 40 years as we have since agriculture began 10,000 years ago. It is the greatest challenge that humanity has ever faced, and we have to do it without destroying the water, the oceans, the soils that we all depend on. It's a staggering challenge.
So let's talk about some ways that we might deal with this challenge and some promising trends that you've identified. You know, decades ago, we had this Green Revolution, which dramatically increased the productivity of agriculture. And one thing, of course, would be terrific would be if that could happen again. And there's been this progress in genetically modifying seeds and plants. It's very controversial. They're banned in some countries. What's the prospect that that would give us an enormous increase in yield that will help us feed more people?
Well, this is part of the great conundrum that that Norman Borlaug mentioned when this technology sort of started coming in the 1970s. There was this great hope that the ability to transfer genes from all these different species would create this, you know, create another green revolution. It was going to save us from where we were heading in terms of population and demand. Unfortunately, even though there have been some environmental benefits to GMOs, and they haven't really caused the dramatic health or environmental damage that that some of the critics have been worried about, they haven't produced that much yield growth either. So conventionally bred crops are producing just as high yields as GMOs. We haven't seen any of this sort of dramatic rise that we saw during Borlaug's era, where we got a doubling, almost tripling of global yield production. It just hasn't happened. So many people are thinking, you know, maybe the yield switch is not one we can genetically manipulate. There's only a certain amount of sunlight coming into plants that can be converted into seed. Maybe we're starting to see the sort of yield cap. And even Borlaug himself said that the Green Revolution would only give us sort of 30 years before it would begin to play out. And almost on cue, in 2000, 30 years after he won the Nobel Peace Prize, you started to see our yields start to flatten out. So we've had no yield growth in wheat and rice basically during the entire first of the 21st century.
Now, there have been some genetically modified seeds developed by corporations which have saved money, have allowed them to make some crops more resistant to certain pesticides, et cetera, but no big yield increases. But as the costs of genetic research has declined, more universities, more nonprofits are taking this on. Are there real prospects that you could find ways to modify plants and seeds to really increase productivity in some crops?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is one of the great hopes that the scientists and these land grant universities and foundations will save us with this new technology. Unfortunately, even though it's now available to them because of the reduction of cost. I mean, you can now sequence a genome on a computer not much more powerful than your smartphone, according to one of the researchers I spoke to. It cost them $99, which is enormously affordable for them. And they have made wonderful strides. Researchers at UC Davis have developed a flood-resistant rice that can withstand 2 weeks of being inundated and still come back and produce a crop. This has been enormously popular and successful in Southeast Asia, where a lot of the rice is grown in very flood-prone areas. Now, the big sort of holy grail of the GMO nonprofits is to create something called C4 rice. This is a type of high-yielding rice that has the potential to boost rice yields by almost 50% by using the same amount of fertilizer, water, and all the inputs. But even though they're working very hard on it, it's still, according to the researchers I spoke to, 20 to 30 years from the farmers' fields. So again, this stuff is all the potential of the genetic manipulation seems to be just out of our reach, just out of the farmers' hands in terms of yield. So we're going to have to solve this problem before those wonder seeds, those miracle seeds get to us.
You write about organic farming, which a lot of us think as sort of a niche activity for people who can afford to pay more to get locally grown, organically raised food. Help us understand the basics here. I mean, what do we mean when we say organic farming? What kind of inputs go into non-organic farming that are left out of organic farming? What does do for the soil, and how can it be used on a wider scale?
Sure. So typically, we had an Organic Standards Act passed in the early 2000s, which banned sort of chemical fertilizers, chemical pesticides, GMO seeds. So everything that organic farmers put on their crops has to pass through a certain standard. It has to be come from a natural source, essentially. It's this focus on increasing organic matter and fertility of the soil so that it grows robust plants that can defend themselves from weeds or insect pests, instead of focusing on maximizing the seed production. And there have been several broad-scale studies looking at yields of organic and conventional agriculture, and typically organic yields 12 to 20% less than high input agriculture. But it really varies on the crop and where you grow it. Some crops, there's almost no yield difference. It's going to make good crops every year. And more importantly, it's going to make farmers more money every year, year in, year out. Something that you can do, for a millennium.
And less vulnerable to bad weather events.
Yeah, in drought conditions, almost they found that organic, because of this extra organic matter in the soil, which creates this wonderful sponge-like texture, the organic crops are typically much more resistant to drought than conventional crops.
You're right about some other things, including what you called the Blue Revolution, the idea of dramatically expanding the farming of seafood, including farms in the ocean. What do you see there?
Well, this is a dream that Jacques Cousteau had back in the 70s, that we would stop being hunters and gatherers of the ocean, which is terribly inefficient, and actually becoming farmers of the sea. The focus here that I've written about is on these sort of novel new ways where aquaculture can really pump out an enormous amount of good, healthy protein with very little impact on the aquatic environment. So one of the examples was an offshore fish farm I visited down in Panama, where they're really in the deep water 8 miles off the coast of Panama, in off the Panama Shelf, and they're growing these cobia in what's called the oligotrophic zone of the ocean, very low nutrient area.
What are cobia? That's a fish species.
Cobia is this white, beautiful white sport fish that's caught by anglers in the southeast of the United States. But it's never been commercially fished because it doesn't really school. It's very difficult for fishermen to catch it. But it's a wonderful aquaculture species, grows fast, very healthy, has a buttery white fillet. And since it has no swim bladder, it uses the oils, the fish oils in its body to help it float. So it has as much of these wonderful omega-3 fatty acids as salmon. So this young farmer has invested in his life savings, and he's an entrepreneur, to build this enormous fish farm off the coast of Panama. If it's successful, and no one has yet made any money farming in the deep offshore waters. Most aquaculture farms are either in freshwater or they're very close to shore. But if he's successful, it could really open up vast swaths of the ocean to fairly low impact aquaculture that could pump out an enormous amount of good, healthy, low fat, you know, protein to a world that desperately needs it.
What does a deep water fish farm look like? Is it like huge vertical nets out under the waves?
Oh, it's very cool. He's got like 8 or 12 of these huge fish pens that look like old gyroscopes we used to play with as children. And yet they're covered in Kevlar netting, and they sink, and they typically subsist about 60 feet below the surface of the ocean. So he had one hurricane that was like a Cat 4 hurricane that went through one of his test farms, didn't lose a single fish. You know, they're down deep below so the ocean energy won't tear them up. So it's an incredible thing. So I went diving in one of these things with this entrepreneur, O'Hanlon was his name, and it's an incredible experience. You're down there, you know, floating around a net pen with 30,000 fish, and yet they were all calm. They didn't seem stressed. It wasn't, you know, the water was incredibly clear. It just seemed like a wonderful way to grow this type of protein for the world.
Are there promising ideas in irrigation and water conservation that will help that?
You know, absolutely. I mean, we waste half the water we apply to crops in general. I mean, we're still using in many parts of the world this flood irrigation we've used since, you know, we started cutting ditches in the Tigris and Euphrates in Mesopotamia. So our current use of water is incredibly inefficient. However, I interviewed one of the fellows on the cusp of this, a Stanford engineering grad, who was developing this ultra cheap micro irrigation that he's selling to farmers in India and China. And again, this is stuff he's designed basically out of the same stuff we make these cheap plastic bags out of. He's got a couple of PVC tubes and a barrel at the end, and you know he can sell this stuff to farmers and get 90%. Water use efficiency out of it at very low cost.
So again, it applies water evenly to plants so you don't waste it? Is that the idea?
Yeah, essentially it's like one of the company's called DripTech, and it's got one of these drip lines that has a little nozzle that goes to each plant. And so instead of, you know, wasting water, flooding it throughout the field and half of it not even getting near the root zone, you know, you're applying just the right amount of water directly to the roots, incredibly efficient, you know, and enormously water-saving, and you're starting to see all kinds of water-saving techniques starting to come about that, you know, as the price of water gets higher or as it gets more limited, you know, farmers are very adaptable, and there are good signs that we'll be able to at least ameliorate some of these water demands that are projected to increase.
As you look at this problem, how much of the challenge we face is a shortage of food as opposed to getting the income into the hands of the people who need it and just managing the public policy mechanisms to make sure that people are fed?
Sure. Well, this is the great conundrum of the food crisis. Part of the problem is poverty, right? We've got half the world that lives on $2 a day and spends 60 to 70% of its income on food. The other part of the problem is growing income. So the world's getting richer. Our middle class in places like China and India are growing astronomically. And when they get more money, they typically eat higher things on the food web. In India, it's dairy. in China, it's pork. So, you know, this great demand for meat, which is expected to double literally within the next decade, is part of the issue because meat takes a lot more grain to produce a pound of meat than it does just eating the grain itself. So as people's incomes rise, we need to figure a way for countries that need better nutrition and can get that from meat to allow them to have that. Whereas countries like the United States and Europe, well, we eat way too much meat. I mean, our meat-centric diet is scheduled to, and high fat, high sugar, high salt, is scheduled to make half of the U.S. population either diabetic or pre-diabetic by 2020. So there are parts of the world that eat way too much of meat protein and parts of the world that don't eat enough. So balancing those out, and I think, and you know, it's already starting, you're already starting to see that because people realize in the United States the health consequences of poor eating habits, and they're trying to adjust. So there is this push because, you know, you don't want to keep the world poor just so they can eat lower on the food chain. You want everybody to move up the ladder. But as we do, we're also going to have to adjust consumption. So these are the two swords. You either increase production or you reduce demand. You reduce consumption by eating lower on the food chain. And, of course, the big question, of course, is how much we can reduce our population or limit population growth between now and the time when the food really starts to get scarce.
You ever going to be a farmer?
You know, that's interesting. Maybe after journalism takes a dive, I'll consider going back. I think I'd be better writing about good farmers than trying to farm myself. But it is a noble profession and one that is critically important, and I think one that we ignore at our own peril.
Joel Bourne, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Dave, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Joel Bourne's book is The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. Coming up, Ed Ward talks about some recordings of underappreciated soul singer Jackie Moore. This is Fresh Air.
Thanks for listening to Fresh Air. Here's another podcast you might want to check out, the TED Radio Hour. You'll hear discussions about questions like, when does learning begin? Are we at the end of privacy? What does the road from curiosity to discovery look like? The program is about new ideas, astonishing inventions, fresh approaches to old problems, and new ways to think and create. You can find the TED Radio Hour podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
This is Fresh Air. Jackie Moore isn't exactly unknown to soul music fans, but she's not as well known as she could be. She recorded with great producers, had great songwriters feeding her material, and was an early beneficiary of the Philly sound. Much of her work was unreleased at the time she recorded. Rock historian Ed Ward says some of her best stuff didn't get the recognition it deserved, but that might change with the release of a double disc of her recordings for Atlantic Records.
Just love on me. Oh, can't you see the need in me? Cover me. Ooh, cover me, oh baby.
Unlike a huge number of soul singers, Jackie Moore's singing didn't start in church back home in Jacksonville, Florida. Instead, she and her girlfriends grew up idolizing soul singers like Aretha Franklin, Gladys Knight, and Mavis Staples, who had grown up in church. Jackie entered talent contests, had a high school group called Jackie and the Jackettes, and took encouragement from her cousin, producer and songwriter Dave Crawford. When she left high school, she moved to Philadelphia, where she lived with relatives, sang in clubs, and tried to get a demo tape to producer Bobby Martin. Finally, she succeeded, and he got her signed to Burt Burns' Shout label, which released two singles that did okay in Philadelphia. The head of the label had his wife manager, and she knew Jerry Wexler at Atlantic, who bought out her contract and gave her one that stipulated she work with Dave Crawford, who was already working at Atlantic. They went into the studio and cut a single.
All my friends, oh, they ask me, Jackie, how you make it? Oh, yeah, with your man,
always gone. Tell me how you take it. That's what they say. They ask me how do I resist temptation? Being all alone. Oh yeah, this is what I tell them. It takes a whole lot of willpower.
Featuring Atlantic's Criterion Studios house band, the Dixie Flyers, augmented by Dr. John, and killer production by Dave Crawford, everyone was happy with Willpower. But when the radio started getting requests, it was for the other side, so they played it instead.
Precious, 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 precious baby.
Precious Precious just sold and sold, even making it onto the pop charts and giving Jackie her only gold record. She'd co-written it with Dave Crawford, so she even made money off of it. Not wanting to stop a winning streak, they recorded at Criterion again with the same musicians minus Dr. John and again came up winners.
You say your days have always been stormy. Hey, your eyes are all red and flooded. Yes, they are. You say you scraped the bottom of the barrel and all of the water down there is sure enough muddy. So listen here.
Sometimes It's Got to Rain was a top 20 soul hit, and Jackie's future looked bright. Crawford had joined forces with a young, up-and-coming producer named Brad Shapiro, who would later turn Millie Jackson into a star. Their next attempt was a song by the Elgins, an obscure Motown group.
Darling baby, life is so lonely without you. Life is so lonely.
This was a smaller hit, as was her follow-up, Time, a Dave Crawford song. Her sales were declining, so Atlantic moved her back to Philadelphia for some sessions in early 1973 and had her switch producers to three guys, Phil Hurt, LeBaron Taylor, and Bunny Sigler, who called themselves the Young Professionals.
There's a guy that they call
Charlie Babe was a pretty good hit and even cracked the pop charts, But Jackie's days on Atlantic were numbered. The label was concentrating more effort on rock, with Led Zeppelin outselling anything they'd ever released before, and soul music was beginning to take a back seat to disco. Now, I've always said that a lot of disco was soul music by different means, but Atlantic wasn't very good at it at first. And so in 1975, Jackie left, spent a couple of years assessing the new situation, and came back as a disco artist, eventually signing with Columbia and making a record with Barry White. By the late 80s, Jackie had retired to raise her kids, but she's still making occasional appearances and knocking them dead.
Ed Ward reviewed Jackie Moore's complete Atlantic recordings on the Real Gone Music label. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new Kate Atkinson novel, A God in Ruins. This is Fresh Air. Kate Atkinson's 2013 novel, Life After Life, won critical praise for its achievement of being both a sweeping historical novel and an ingeniously constructed account of one woman's rather bumpy life's journey. Now Atkinson has written what she calls a companion to Life After Life. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of A God in Ruins, which is also the selection for the Morning Edition Book Club.
On the 70th anniversary of VE Day this year, a landmark restaurant here in Washington, D.C., invited all World War II veterans to come in and eat free. That restaurant later posted a picture of the vets who showed up. They were spry and smiling, and there were three of them, just three. As commentators keep reminding us, soon there won't be any World War II vets left to tell the rest of us firsthand what that war was like. Kate Atkinson's magnificent new novel, A God in Ruins, both mourns the passing of the World War II generation and offers the consolation of fiction as a way to vicariously enter into the experience of the war. Atkinson is tough to categorize. Her work ranges from straight detective tales to elaborately plotted, often meta-conscious literary fiction, such as Behind the Scenes at the Museum, which won the 1995 Whitbread Award. Even her naughtiest narratives, though, are distinguished by their sense of compassion. For instance, in Life After Life, her best-selling 2013 novel, Atkinson tells the story of Ursula Todd, an English woman born in 1910 who dies repeatedly. In succession, Ursula is murdered, commits suicide, falls victim to influenza and the Blitz, and then she's reborn over and over. Ursula's sequential rebootings bring home the contingencies of life, the relative powerlessness we all share in the face of larger forces like war. Atkinson calls A God in Ruins a companion novel to Life After Life, although I don't think you have to have read the earlier book to appreciate this one. In A God in Ruins, Atkinson has written a novel that takes its place in the line of powerful works about young men and war, stretching from Stephen Crane's Red Badge of Courage to Kevin Powers' The Yellowbirds and Ben Fountain's Billy Lynn's Halftime Walk. A God in Ruins spotlights Ursula's younger brother, Teddy, and his service as an RAF bomber pilot during World War II. In stop-and-start fashion, the novel hops around in perspective and era, from Teddy's golden between-the-wars childhood to his grim fade-out as a nonagenarian in this century. Atkinson's non-linear storyline enhances the poignancy of time passing. For instance, during the Blitz, a young Teddy on leave recklessly spends his money on drinks and a hotel room because, after all, as the saying goes, there are no pockets in shrouds. A couple of pages on, however, we're in the 1990s, and Teddy's grandson, who's cleaning out his house and moving him to assisted living, complains that Granddad's got so much crap. Likewise, in the blink of an eye, the goldfish that Teddy, as a young father, wins at an agricultural fair for his cranky daughter is prefigured in Teddy's membership in the so-called Goldfish Club of bomber pilots who ditch their planes into the sea. Much later on, Teddy will think of himself as a goldfish in captivity at his assisted living residence. Atkinson fluidly executes these chronological loop-de-loops, leaving a reader to marvel at that most banal of epiphanies, how fast life goes by. That is, how fast life goes by if one is lucky enough to enjoy a normal lifespan. Most of those RAF crewmen were not. In an afterword, Atkinson reminds us that the average age of these men, boys really, all volunteers, was 22. Less than half of them survived. Drawing on firsthand accounts of those airmen's experiences, Atkinson writes extended battle scenes that bring Teddy and his crew into the thick of things, from bombing missions over Germany to freak engine trouble to titanic thunderstorms, any of which might prove fatal. Atkinson's skills as a suspense writer serve her well here. It's not till the final pages of the novel that we readers learn who makes it through the war and who doesn't. As powerfully as it conveys life and death struggles in the air, A God in Ruins also compels readers to recognize the courage of those who survived, to quietly pick up the pieces and graciously attend, in ever-dwindling numbers, memorial ceremonies and veterans' dinners.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. She reviewed A God in Ruins by Kate Atkinson. Tomorrow, journalist Nisad Hajjari talks about the legacy of the 1947 partition of India that created Pakistan. He'll discuss the violence that surrounded that partition, why those tensions persist today, and how they've led to Pakistan's support of extremist groups like the Taliban. Hajjari's new book is Midnight's Furies. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.